This is Jewish Board Talk with Cherise Zifford, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
Later today, 2 p.m. South African time, the ICJ will rule on South Africa's genocide case against Israel. Last week, André Thomashausen, UNISA Emeritus Professor of Comparative and International Law, was my guest to provide clarity in what the SAJBD has described as South Africa's inversion of the truth. Professor Thomashausen is my guest again this week to again be a voice of reason and provide insight into the possible scenarios. I'm delighted to have him back. Professor, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me.
Yes, good afternoon. Good afternoon, listeners. It's a pleasure to be back here.
Prof, I didn't think when we spoke last week that the ruling would come out so quickly. What are the possible scenarios?
Look, I think the first overriding, very big scenario which people have lost out of sight is that South Africa is in a phase of its history where its economy is extremely vulnerable. Just take, for example, our coal exports. They are half of what they were 10 years ago, and we don't export much else. A lot of our engineering industries have closed. And our agricultural exports, which account for about 12% of our GDP, are seriously threatened because the ports are no longer functioning. Most of our fresh produce, our fruit, our vegetables will die in the ports because it cannot be cooled forever, and there are hundreds of ships trying to load. So we are economically very vulnerable. We're living of huge credit lines, also international credit lines, and we're taking out more credit to service the existing credit lines, to pay the interest on those credit lines. At that stage, to become the only country in the world, over 240 United Nations member states, that sticks out its head and takes on basically the rest of the world and says, no, we will be the moral guardians. We will we'll make sure that a country that we believe is guilty of genocide will be found to be guilty of genocide and will be brandished and will be isolated and will be subjected to sanctions, and that is directed against Israel. So this puts South Africa in direct opposition to the countries that are the main and actually the only foreign investors in this country, the nations of the European Union, foremost England and Germany and France, but also Belgium, and of course the United States and Japan. So this is, I think it's probably not been considered well, and should the court now side with the South African application, then we will see a very big rift in our foreign relations. We will have to look at our new partners, at Iran, at Sudan, at Yemen, at maybe North Korea, to replace the economic role of the EU, the US, and Japan.
Professor, you paint a very bleak picture, yet you and I both read the same media. And if you read our media, you will learn that South Africa is raised its international profile. It has stood out against, in their minds, oppression, and that this has given South Africa a new lease on the international stage.
Well, this is what some of the media who likes to be close to the government, or who for some reason or before the election has chosen to praise the government, which is essentially a failed government. It has driven a once industrialized nation into a situation of near state bankruptcy. That is what this media is portraying at the moment, and there's a lot of effort being put into the social media and Facebook and Instagram to brandish Israel and to call this something that makes South Africa proud, and that it's the biggest event in South Africa's history since the assumption of the presidency by Nelson Mandela. But the reality is that that this is siding with nations and with a political ideology that contradicts all the fundamental values of the South African Constitution and of the things that were established during the Mandela era. For instance, our abhorrence against the death penalty. Well, all the countries that are supporting Hamas and that are very loudly supporting South Africa's court action, they practice the death penalty very regularly and very cruelly so. If you decide to hang a human being from a crane so that everybody can watch that corpse slowly dying, then that is cruel and inhuman, and that is the practice in Iran. We are also very proud that we have gender equality. We even have quotas for gender equality, including in our parliament. But we are siding with nations that definitely do not acknowledge equal rights to women, and in some of them, women are treated in a most inhumane and horrible fashion. So it is a strange shift in our foreign policy, and it raises the question, who actually controls our foreign policy? Who actually makes these choices?
And what is your guess?
Well, it's amongst constitutional lawyers, it's an old debate. Some scholars, some colleagues of mine, refer to foreign policy making as the fourth power in the state. And this is why after the Vietnam War, the American Constitution was changed to remove the war powers from the president. Because it was felt it shouldn't just be one person that, for instance, decides to take a country to war. And the foreign policy power normally is shared between parliament and the executive. But in the practice of the South African, of the current South African government, this fundamental choice, this very fundamental decision to take Israel and accuse it at the most public forum, at the International Court of Justice, of all things, accuse Israel of genocide, Israel being the nation that was a victim of genocide. That decision was taken, I doubt it was even taken by the president. I think the Minister of Foreign Affairs, whom we call International Relations, Dirko, Mrs. Pandor just took this decision, and her advisor, Ashraf Suleiman, former ambassador of South Africa in Palestine, and I think they ran with it. And Parliament didn't feel the need to debate it, and that is very worrying.
It is very worrying, and what's more worrying is what will come out at 2 p.m. What are the options? What are the scenarios?
Well, let us wait for the result. If the court does not accept the application of South Africa, but in the central parts refuses to make a finding that Israel could be found to be guilty of genocide, or that there is maybe a discernible risk that Israel could in the future become genocidal, if the court rejects that, then I think here at home there will have to be a reflection exactly on the responsibility for foreign policy, because the decision of one minister may have done a great lot of harm to South Africa and to South African economy. And of course, to a lot of South African citizens who suddenly are scared and who are suddenly wondering whether they can find an ancestor that might enable them to re-emigrate back to Europe, for instance. So there should be a consequence. And I feel generally that government ministers are like heads of department. And in all South African universities, for instance, a head of department can only serve two terms. And in my case at UNISA, it was 8 years. So why should that not apply to government ministers? Why should we only expect the president to be limited in the number of terms that he can serve? Why shouldn't the ministers also be exchanged regularly? Because it is a normal life experience that your energy, your capacity to have original and new ideas, your ability to motivate others, all the basic management skills, they become exhausted after 8 or 10 years. And it is good to allow others then to take a chance and to rule. Nobody is unique, and people shouldn't make themselves believe that they are unique, that South Africa's international relations will end with Minister Pandor. They will not. That is the one view I have. And of course, the Minister of Justice would have to also answer questions. How did South Africa fail to succeed at the International Criminal Court and in the process incur the wrath and the rejection of our main foreign investment partners? But should the court actually follow what seems to become a very widespread sentiment in the world, that Israel's self-defense in Gaza is excessive, that there's an excessive use of force, that there are too many non-combatant victims, then we will have to see how South Africa can reconcile, for instance, with not just U.S. foreign policy, but with a very large number of members of Congress and of senators in America, who very soon will have to decide whether the preferential trading agreement with South Africa, the AGOA agreement, could be renewed or not. So in both cases, I think President Ramaphosa will have some uncomfortable decisions to take.
Professor, when should either it fail or it win South Africa? What is the next step? I mean, South Africa seems hell-bent on punishing Israel. If this... What is its next step?
Well, I personally, when I look at these things and I analyze them, I wish we could come back to the original decision that President Ramaphosa announced after the 7th of October. Obviously, he didn't know that his Minister of Foreign Affairs or International Relations at that time, on the 9th of October, was already in Tehran, having long and intimate discussions and meetings with the President of Iran. But President Ramaphosa said in public that he would want South Africa to help Israel in its predicament and bring to the table South Africa's experience in negotiating difficult conflicts, and that he personally was involved in the negotiations that avoided a civil war in South Africa. So I would wish that we could come back to that readiness to be constructive. And to be constructive, of course, would have to involve some thinking out of the box. And maybe South Africa is a completely, as a nation which is not in the region, not present in the region, could host a brainstorming conference where one would bring together 20 or 30 of the most renowned people, like American Professor Falk or so many that have contributed to conflict resolution, to really examine the options. What are the options to overcome the decade-old conflict that Israel finds itself in with the Palestine people?
Sure. I wish we could talk more. Professor, we have to leave it there. But thank you so much for joining. We'll know kind of in the next hour or so exactly what goes down, and perhaps you'll be my guest to review it in a week's time again.
With pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was Professor Andrea Thomashausen, UNISA Emeritus Professor of Comparative and International Law.